I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Tito's handmade vodka had been mixed with its fair share of cocktails. But one night, a chilled glass topped with lime and cranberry would change everything this bottle knew about happy hour. From the producers of America's favorite vodka, it turns out the cocktail you've been waiting for was right there the whole time. The Tito's Rum Cosmo. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll sip with Tito's. Coming to cocktail parties near you at Tito'sVodka.com. 40% alcohol by volume, namely 80 proof, crafted to be savored responsibly.
There are a few periods in Western history as fascinating overall and perhaps as far-reaching as the Italian Renaissance. This great rebirth of art, music, literature, and to be sure, architecture that began in 15th century Florence brought back the glory and profound human significance of the ancient Greek and Roman civilizations. Many art historians and architectural scholars suggest that perhaps America, too, had a renaissance during the late 19th century. Again, a rebirth of classical style, cultural importance, and democratic dominance that indeed brought this new fledgling country into a modern age. The so-called American Renaissance was a long period, depending on which historian you talk with. Many suggest it began with the Great Centennial Exhibition in 1876 and ran all the way up to the beginning of World War I in 1914. And some argue it went even into the early 1920s. The period we call the Gilded Age was part of this larger American Renaissance. It was a period when America tried to adopt aspects of European culture and society, and sometimes conscientiously and sometimes clumsily blend them into a new vision and style uniquely our own, something uniquely American. Perhaps the greatest manifestations of the American Renaissance, and indeed one of its more revolutionary expressions, took place in the world of architecture. In cities across the United States, but nowhere more than in New York City itself, imposing new citadels to culture, great and grand, were built to show that America could now compete with Europe's great cultural history and show off newly minted American money and financial power. Ironically, a number of these strongholds showing off this new empire have been lost to history, but those that remain have become some of our most treasured cultural institutions with respect for the past, but a definite eye toward the future. In this episode, I am joined by architectural historian, interior designer, and architect Philip James Dodd to delve deeply into the American Renaissance, what it meant, who some of the major players were, and what remains of their work that we can see and admire today. I'm Carl Raymond, the host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast, where every 2 weeks we journey into corners light and dark for a look at America's Gilded Age, France's Belle Époque, and England's late Victorian and Edwardian eras. The Metropolitan Museum of Art is unquestionably one of New York City's greatest treasures and is invariably my answer when unfairly questioned, what is the one place someone first visiting New York should go? The Met, of course, represents over 5,000 years of artistic vision from world cultures, and the very first object acquired by the Met upon its founding in 1870, an ancient Roman sarcophagus, remains on view for the museum's over 3 million visitors today. The Met building today shows the work of several architects that contributed to the sprawling, honeycombed wings and galleries since its Fifth Avenue location on the edge of Central Park opened in 1880. In particular, it is the great facade and cathedral-like Great Hall, additions which opened to the public in 1902. It's how these spectacular creations came to be. They are very much a New York story, and one that without the influence of the American Renaissance and one of its greatest exponents, the American architect Gilded Age Richard Morris Hunt, well, they just would not have happened. The Met's extraordinary collection very much represents a world view through history, but the first impressions that we see as we appreciate and enter that grand portal are very much a New York tale, and one fueled by the American Renaissance and the Gilded Age. With me today to take a look at not only the Met, but several examples of American Renaissance architecture and the style known as Beaux-Arts, is my guest, Philip James Dodd. Philip James Dodd was born and raised in the UK and moved to America more than 20 years ago and founded his eponymous design firm in 2015. Philip is an alumnus of the Prince of Wales Institute of Architecture in London, has a master's degree in architecture from the University of Notre Dame, and has trained with a number of the most recognized classical architecture firms in the country. His designs can be found in New York, Greenwich, Connecticut, Palm Beach, Florida, and even in Bangalore, India. In addition to his award-winning design work, Philip is also the author of several best-selling books, including most recently, An American Renaissance, Beaux-Arts Architecture in New York City, published in 2021, which features a foreword by Julian Fellows and which serves as the basis for our conversation today. Philip, I am so honored to have you join me on The Gilded Gentleman. Welcome to the table.
Blimey, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
I am so glad you're here. Now, Philip, I'd really like to focus much of this episode on really establishing the difference between two things here. One, a particular period of architectural history called the American Renaissance, and the other, an actual style of architecture that truly formed the look of the Gilded Age, from an architectural point of view, of course, called Beaux-Arts. So at first, can you describe or define an American Renaissance? What does that mean, and how did that come to be?
So I think when you think of the word Renaissance, Renaissance is just Italian for rebirth. And you go through history, you look at the Italian Renaissance, you look at, you know, other renaissances that have occurred, and you associate it with a rebirth in architecture and the arts. But I think what goes hand in hand with that is technological advancements, which allow especially changes in architecture to occur. So these are kind of dramatic shifts in society. There was one a generation earlier in England with the Industrial Revolution and all the technological advancements that the British were making. And then the same thing happens here. You're coming out of the Civil War. People have got, as Julian writes about this in the foreword to the book, it's the first time that Americans have got more money than anybody else. And so they're able to do things that a generation earlier were, you know, they couldn't even dream about doing. It's interchangeable with the term the Gilded Age, of course. The way I liken it to is there's no real Gilded Age. You have the Gilded Age and you have the Progressive Era from a social point of view. There is no Progressive Era architecture. So it all kind of falls under this umbrella of an American Renaissance. Otherwise, you get social historians complaining that the dates are incorrect. So it's kind of a broader umbrella, and That's how I kind of describe it, if that makes sense.
One of the things I was fascinated in reading your book was the American Renaissance sort of roughly starts post-Civil War, let's just say 1870, but it actually goes a bit into the 20th century. You could even argue it goes up to the 1920s. Do you agree with that?
So, you know, what's funny? I'm starting right now to work on my next book, which is got a working title, Mansions of the Gilded Age. And I'm talking to some of the later buildings, and they cannot make up their mind. Some of them are firmly in, we are a Gilded Age mansion. Even though we were built in the 20s, we are a Gilded Age mansion. And others are like, no, we're actually not a Gilded Age mansion. And I was like, well, don't you want to jump on the bandwagon? This is good PR for you. And they're like, no, we are not a Gilded Age mansion. So it's you kind of get into pedantics. The way I think about it, again, from an architectural point of view, is this is an era that spans from the picturesque Victorian to modern, I guess going into Art Deco. Everything in between for me is this American Renaissance architecture. And that's what I think of also as the Gilded Age.
Now, how is this American Renaissance alike, or maybe not alike, the Italian Renaissance or even the world of Imperial Rome? Because it seems like there maybe are some parallels that we could draw between all of these. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why New York is the Empire State. It's all about empire building, really. And so the Brits are building an empire in the Italian Renaissance. And it's not just that. In England, during the Industrial Revolution, the merchant bankers, Manchester was the center of the cotton industry. It was referred to as Cottonopolis. And they likened themselves to being Medici bankers. Same thing happens in the American Renaissance. The great bankers like J.P. Morgan and Otto Kahn, they think of themselves as being modern-day versions of Medici's. They want to live in Italian palazzos, and they want to be patrons to the arts. And that's kind of one of the key things here.
Absolutely. And we're going to come back to that, particularly when we talk about J.P. Morgan and Henry Clay Frick. Speaking of the Medici's, it was fascinating. Just a few weeks ago, I was up in Hyde Park at the Vanderbilt Mansion. And in the dining room of the Vanderbilt Mansion, Frederick Vanderbilt actually has the coat of arms of the Medici's. How much more direct correlation could you get?
Yeah, they were trying to, I mean, you know the stories about this, but a lot of these newly minted families, they had no coat of arms. So they didn't care what they were stealing, what they were sourcing to try and give them some instant history. So yeah, you kind of see things all the time.
Just steal someone else's.
Yeah, and you know, I know we're going to talk about the Morgan a little bit later, but that really is this lesson in stealing all these emblems from the Italian Renaissance.
Sure. Now, when we're talking about architects of the period, which we're certainly going to get into, there was another moment in your book that I particularly loved, and it was a quote from John Ruskin, who was so incredibly important in the 19th century. And the quote of Ruskin's is, "No person who is not a great sculptor or painter can be an architect. If he is not a sculptor or painter, he can only be a builder." I thought that was fascinating. Philip, can you explain that? What does that mean?
So obviously, Ruskin's a little bit early. He's from Victorianism, but I did like that kind of quote. And it fits perfectly with the notion of Beaux-Arts architecture, which we'll talk about. Because it's not just architecture with decoration. The architecture, which translates as the art of building, integrated with sculpture and mural painting. So they weren't just forms of decoration that were applied afterwards. So when the architect was creating the space, they knew they weren't carving it, they weren't painting it for themselves, but they knew that this is what they would be doing. And that's really what elevates a lot of the great, especially civic architecture, because it's this inclusion of mural painting and sculpture to go with the architecture.
It seems to me one of the really important points here in all of this is that the ideology behind all of this is not just the idea of building separate, distinct, individual buildings, but it was the idea of creating a whole new city or a whole new empire, as you just referred to a couple of minutes ago. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think that's really important in this concept of American Renaissance, right?
Yeah. So again, you're coming out of the Civil War. They've got all of this money, and especially the old money families. So J.P. Morgan came from old money. You think of this era as newly minted millionaires, but Morgan wasn't, Otto Kahn wasn't. And these people were incredibly well-versed in history and the arts. And they realized that to create a city on the world stage, they had to add a civic component to that. And part of the problem is, you know, at this time, America is not an old country. It's not got this layers of history which the European cities had, and they wanted to emulate those European cities. They wanted to be like London. They wanted to be like Paris and Rome. And that kind of ties in with the form, at the same time, the city beautiful movement is coming in. And so it all kind of ties together. So it fits in with them being patrons of the arts, but creating these big civic monuments. Some of the families weren't so much like that. I don't think you really associate, especially earlier generations, you don't associate earlier generations of the Vanderbilts, for example, for doing that. It was about building lavish homes for themselves. You know, J.P. Morgan came from this old money where his father had told him it was ostentatious to show one's wealth. And so the Astors, the Vanderbilts, they lived in, you know, quite plain brownstones. But they wanted to create these civic buildings. And at the time, and I think this is interesting because people don't really think about this now, is New York was obviously already the economic center of this country with Wall Street. And Washington, D.C. was the political center. But it hadn't been determined what the cultural capital of America would be. And at this time, you've got New York, Boston, and Chicago all competing to see who is going to be the cultural capital. And Chicago thinks it gets the upper hand when it gets the World Columbian Exposition and builds the White City. For a little while, Boston had the upper hand when it built Boston Public Library, because at that point, New York didn't have any structures like that. And that was really one of the impetus for all of the captains of industry and the elders in New York City to come together and decide, you know, we can't have this. If they're building this elsewhere, you know, we've got to get to it and build these buildings here in New York.
Now, despite all these truly grand, both public and private buildings that were being constructed during the Gilded Age, there was another fascinating comment that you make in the book, which was there was still a lack of permanence in constructing them. And really, in indeed, relatively few of them lasted more than 10, maybe 20 years. And I found that fascinating because so many of the great buildings in Europe were built to last centuries. And they have, but not here and not at this point. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I think that this gets into a little bit of a dodgy subject here with facadism. But I think a lot of this was facadism. They were building, they were spending their money where they wanted you to see it. You go around the backs of some of these buildings and when they were built, they were held together by Scotch tape. But that was no different than what they were doing in London with Nash, for example, building his mansions along Regent's Park. But again, the key thing here in New York is the technological advancements that were occurring. So all of a sudden, they could build taller when a generation they couldn't. And it all came down to the value of the land. So one of the great examples is in Madison Square, you get Stanford White's, one of his great masterpieces, the Madison Square Presbyterian Church. I think it stood for 10 years, perhaps. Then it was knocked down. It was replaced with a 16-story office building, which only stood for 10 years before that was knocked down. And that was meant to be replaced with a 100-story MetLife North building. They only built the first 30 floors of that before they ran out of money because it was in the Great Depression. And it was never finished. So if you stand in Madison Square, you can see it's next to the regular MetLife building where you see, which is based on the Campanile in Venice, but next to it is this quite squat building because it was meant to have another 70 stories go on top of it. But again, when they built it 10 stories tall, it was because that's all they could build. And then as technology changes and the steel framing comes in and the elevator comes in and electricity gets invented, and electricity allows them to have pneumatic drills, all sorts of things that can speed up how long it takes to build something. So New York Public Library took tremendous amount of time to build because they kind of started it before these technological advancements had kicked in. I think it was like 15 or 16 years it took. The Frick collection took 18 months because by that time, the technology was there to allow them to do that.
And with that, Philip and I are going to take a short break, but we'll be back to continue the story.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Tito's handmade vodka had been mixed with its fair share of cocktails. But one night, a chilled glass topped with lime and cranberry would change everything this bottle knew about happy hour. From the producers of America's favorite vodka, it turns out the cocktail you've been waiting for was right there the whole time. The Tito's Rum Cosmo. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll sip with Tito's. Coming to cocktail parties near you at Tito'sVodka.com. 40% alcohol by volume, namely 80 proof, crafted to be savored responsibly.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm with architect and interior designer Philip James Dodd for a look at the American Renaissance and the Beaux-Arts architecture of New York. Now, I'd really like to address the second part of this that I mentioned at the beginning. And this is actual Beaux-Arts style. So the style of architecture that really informed this period. So, Philip, can you define that, define Beaux-Arts, and share with us just really how that began and then why it became such a dominant influence in architecture in the Gilded Age?
So you have to remember, at this point in time, there's no architecture schools in America, and there's really no professional architects. They're gentlemen who dabble, basically, or they come over from England to practice, like Calvert Vaux did. The first proper architect in America is really Richard Morris Hunt. And he is the first American to go and study at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, which is this fabled school. Beaux-Arts just translates as fine arts. And while he's there, they're taught this in a system of an atelier, where the professor teaches the older students teach the younger students, and that kind of trickles down. And they're taught this variety of styles, not one style. They're taught the architecture of ancient Greece, of ancient Rome, of the Italian and French Renaissance. And then they travel around Europe, and that's when they discover medieval architecture, and especially the medieval architecture, which was being built at the time in the UK, so which we refer to as perpendicular Gothic. So you think of Westminster and the Houses of Parliament, they were all new buildings built just a generation earlier. Then the second American to go to the École is H.H. Richardson from Boston, the designer of Trinity Church up there. And then most importantly, the third person to go is Charles McKim, who had become the senior partner at McKim, Eden White. After that, the floodgates open, and almost every architect of consequence from the era goes to study at the École. And there's a few exceptions. Stanford White doesn't go. and George Post doesn't go, and Daniel Burnham doesn't go, who here designed the Flatiron Building. They made sure that their sons attended to get the education they didn't. And when they came back to America, they kind of blended all of these styles together, because that's what America is. It's a blending of different traditions. And they blended the architecture together into what I refer to as American Beaux-Arts. So when you just refer to Beaux-Arts on its own, I think people think of grand kind of French palaces. So, you know, in Paris, you think of the opera house, Garnier's opera house. And I think the closest interpretations to that here in New York are like, you know, New York Public Library, Grand Central Station. But American Beaux-Arts runs the gamut. It includes Italian Palazzo architecture. It includes the Gothic Perpendicular. So the Woolworth Building falls into that category. And you get architects like Cass Gilbert, who is just as well-versed designing a perpendicular Gothic skyscraper like the Woolworth Building as he is designing the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. And that's what's really fascinating, is how they interpreted it when they all came back to the States.
So if these Americans were coming back and they were essentially copying Europe, it's fascinating when you look through your book and look at the range of buildings that you include, and you can almost see buildings that are familiar to us that have spent time in Europe. Were there particular places? I mean, I think of the Pantheon, for example, in Rome. Were there particular buildings that seem to be copied and used as models?
So what's interesting, it depends on the architect. And so Charles McKim, for example, I love McKim. When he designed, he would sit down at his drafting table with two draftsmen from his office. And they had an amazing library. And he had this photographic memory. And he would say, you know, I want the windows to look like the Villa Madama. And one draftsman would go into the library to come back with a book where there was a drawing of it. And the other draftsman sat at the board would draw that down. And then he would say, and actually, I want the coins to look like this palazzo. And that's why when you look at any of McKim's buildings, they look familiar, but they're not copies of any particular building because he spliced them all so perfectly together. You can, if you're well-versed in architecture, you can pick the elements. Some buildings are not like that. So Stamford White was a lot more literal. So anybody who knows the Metropolitan Club in New York City, they look at that and they go, oh, well, it's based on the Palazzo Farnese in Rome. It is, but it's by way of the Reform Club in London, because the Reform Club had been built 50 years earlier by Sir Charles Barry. And everyone knows Sir Charles Barry now because of Downton Abbey fame of Highclere Castle. And it was something that, and White, even though he hadn't been to the École des Beaux-Arts, he spent a lot of time in London. And he sourced a lot of architecture from London. So if you go up to the Gould Memorial Library in the Bronx, the inside of that, and this was reported when it first opened, the New York Times reported this, that it was a very close replica to the library at the British Museum. And then when he designed the facade of the Century Association here in Midtown, the facade of that is based on a club in London called White's. And it was an in-house joke in McKim, Mead & White that Stamford White had copied White to do this. So he was a lot more literal in how he used buildings. I much prefer McKim's way of doing it. For me, it's a lot more intellectual. And I think, you know, of course, a lot of people weren't traveled. And so they didn't know what these buildings were based on. To most people, they were original. And then they see these buildings, especially the Italian buildings, and they realize, oh, it's based upon this.
So with all this copying and really translating into a new style, American Beaux-Arts, what's the element that's most American about that? Is it simply taking bits of everything else? What's the American part?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say they were copying. I would say they were sourcing. I think that's maybe a little bit more polite. And one of my favorite quotes is from the modernist architect Le Corbusier. And he said, if you want to see the best examples of Italian palazzos, you don't go to Rome, you go to New York City. So they must have done something right. But I think, you know, when you think of, I think most people, and I was like this, I came to America in the fall of 1996. I didn't know much about New York. And I expected to come into a city full of skyscrapers, and you do. But then I discovered it was a city full of classical buildings, which I then learned were what we call Beaux-Arts buildings. But you get a tremendous amount of beautiful skyscrapers. And of course, the skyscrapers in American invention. And they don't all have to be modern. You can have the Woolworth Building. You can have, my favorite skyscraper of them all is the Standard Oil Building. I think that's just a stunning skyscraper down by Bowling Green. And these were built during this era. So they don't, you know, I mean, you get the Art Deco skyscrapers that people know, like, you know, the Chrysler Building and even the Empire State Building, which architecturally is not that great, but it's just, you know, the classical skyscrapers are stunning though.
So for this next section coming up, I'd really like to take a close look at three of the buildings that you cover. Now, in your book, and I must say that you cover an astonishing 20 individual buildings in your book, it's really an amazing selection. But of the three that we're going to be talking about, two were meant as public buildings and one was a private home. And I'd certainly like to take a look at the architects of each. You've mentioned a couple of them already in the show, what their vision was, how it was executed, and just who was responsible for all of this, because I think that really will give listeners a very wide overview of Beaux-Arts architecture. So I want to start with the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Really, some say it's the greatest building in all of New York City. It's the number one tourist attraction. So what we're talking here, the architect, well, we're talking about Richard Morris Hunt, who created the Fifth Avenue facade and the Great Hall in 1902. One of the fascinating things that you detail in your chapter on the Metropolitan Museum of Art is when Richard Morris Hunt arrived to create the facade and the Great Hall, he actually had to contend with the work of several architects that had built part of the building before, right? So it's sort of, the Met is kind of a who's who of American architects at this time. Am I correct about that? And how did Richard Morris Hunt get involved in this? And what did he do?
You know, so when we started work on this book, the publisher said to us, you have to include the Met. And I didn't want to because it's so big. I was like, how do I mean, we only had 20 buildings and over 400 pages. It means we're just, you know, we're showing them in depth, but you could write a 400 page book just upon the Met. And I thought I knew the Met quite well, but then you go and you study it and research it. And the Met is a unique building in New York City because, as we've already talked about, if a building became too small, they knocked it down. They built something bigger. They knocked it down. They built something even bigger. The Met didn't do that. The Met added wings. And so over 150 years, it's almost become this living, breathing history of how architecture styles have changed in New York over that period, which to me makes it fascinating because it's not just one style. For some people, they find that infuriating. But for me, I find that amazing to see how architecture has evolved. And what you think of as the entrance by Richard Morris Hunt is Wing D. And the original steps were replaced. Kevin Roach replaced those steps. But if you go up the steps, you go through the Great Hall, you go to the rear of the building, you turn around, what you're looking at, and by then you're in the Lehman Gallery. You turn around and what you're looking at is a facade of the original Wing A, which was by Calvert Vaux, we mentioned a little bit earlier. And it faced onto Central Park, which made sense because Vaux was the architect of Central Park. People forget about him. Everyone remembers Olmsted, but Olmsted was a junior partner. Vaux was the senior partner. And so it made sense that the museum would face onto the park. Then they added the second and the third wings, which are almost identical. The second wing, Wing B, faces south. That's now, it's covered by an atrium space. That's now the Petrie Sculpture Gallery. Many people go in there and they think that's the original wing to the Met, but that was actually the second one. And the interesting thing here with Hunt is, and it's a little bit like the narrative that you see going on in the TV series, The Gilded Age, this battle between the old money and the new money. And Hunt is very much the architect He's the architectural choice of new money. This is the new style that he is proposing, this classicism. And Vaux's style, the Victorianism, is what the old money wants. And so the trustees, it takes time for the trustees to kind of whittle through to be a majority. They go from being a majority of old money to becoming in the majority of new money. So it takes until the fourth iteration, the fourth wing, that the new money can actually get their architect, which is why Hunt had to wait so long. He's kind of waving his arms in the background going, look at me, I'm doing all these amazing buildings. Why can't you pick me to do this? And especially with Wing B, it's by Theodore Weston, who really wasn't even an architect. He was a civil engineer by training. It just made no sense. But the old money was digging their heels in. And we're like, we are not going to do this. So that's kind of what makes it this fascinating, because it's not just about the architecture. It's that cultural shift that's going on at the time. And really, you know, we don't think about this, but there was like a nanosecond where they were trying to figure out what would be the architectural style of this era. And of course, all of a sudden the floodgates opened and it became this monumental style of Beaux-Arts architecture. But for a while, it was touch and go.
You've actually written in the book that the Met actually became Beaux-Arts with Richard Morris Hunt's contributions. You think that's the accurate summation of that?
And when this was built, when he did his wing, nobody had seen anything like this before. There was not a civic building in New York remotely of this scale. They used Gustavino to do the vaulting. Up until that point, there was a limit to how big a space could be because of structural support. And so this was just awe-inspiring for people to come in and see this space. You see old photographs and from the outside, and you see the horse-drawn carriages pulling up, and you realize the scale of this building compared to what was there beforehand.
Now, there are so many visitors, New Yorkers and visitors alike, that come to the Met, that look at the facade in the Great Hall. When you wander around the Great Hall or when you look at the facade, are there any particular details that you would want visitors to particularly notice? Are there things that you love about what Hunt did?
So if you'd have asked me this question when I first published a book, I'd have a different answer for you. Because since then, I've done a number of lectures around the country, and I kind of took it for granted that a lot of people knew a lot of what I thought were well-known stories. And then I find out that they actually don't. And I don't know if that's because this is a younger generation that's getting involved, and maybe because of a TV series, and they're fascinated by this, but they don't know a lot of the backstories. And so obviously the most famous backstory is you look on the facade, and Hunt did a lot of work with the sculptor Carl Bitter, and Carl Bitter did all of the sculpture on the, and there's a tremendous amount of sculpture on the front of the Fifth Avenue facade of the Met. But what's most famous is the sculpture that's missing. And so actually, Hunt passed away before they even started construction on the building. It was designed, and his son, Richard Howland Hunt, took over to oversee construction. And above the columns at the entrances were meant to be these four huge allegorical sculptures that represented different periods in art. And this ties into what I said about how sculpture was such an important component of Beaux-Arts architecture, and especially allegorical sculpture, where it's telling a story and they're using figures to depict history. And at the last minute, the Met, which at the time was being run by J.P. Morgan. So it's kind of hard to believe this, but the Met said they had no money left. They couldn't afford to do the sculpture. And so Richard Howland Hunt must have been a little bit passive aggressive. And so he decides to hoist these unfinished blocks of stone up there, thinking that they're so unsightly that the Met will make him take them down and he can put up the sculpture that his father had always, thought would be part of a design. And you can see how well that game plan went, because 150-odd years later, they're still there. And a lot of people think that it was intentional, that there are these kind of, minarets that are up there meant to represent something. It was somebody being passive-aggressive, and it didn't work out.
Well, they look good, though, don't you think?
Well, everybody just got so used to them. They're so famous.
And with that, Philip and I are going to take a short break, but we'll be back to continue the story.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Tito's handmade vodka had been mixed with its fair share of cocktails. But one night, a chilled glass topped with lime and cranberry would change everything this bottle knew about happy hour. From the producers of America's favorite vodka, it turns out the cocktail you've been waiting for was right there the whole time. The Tito's Rum Cosmo. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll sip with Tito's. Coming to cocktail parties near you at Tito'sVodka.com. 40% alcohol by volume, namely 80 proof, crafted to be savored responsibly.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. Like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm with architect and interior designer Philip James Dodd for a look at the American Renaissance and the Beaux-Arts architecture of New York. Now, J.P. Morgan is a perfect transition to the next building I'd like to look at, which, of course, is J.P. Morgan's library, which was designed by Charles Fallon McKim that you mentioned in the earlier section. So we get a little chance to talk about him. Now, this was 1906, so we're a few years after the Metropolitan Museum of Art facade and Great Hall. Now, J.P. Morgan, I found so interesting because he was kind of an outlier among the Gilded Age robber barons in terms of, as you mentioned earlier in the show, he didn't create great, immense architecture the way the Vanderbilts and the Astors and some others did. He lived in a relatively modest, that term is relative, a brownstone on Madison Avenue. And his focus was really about enriching America's cultural status by collecting artworks and, of course, the library. Do you think that's a fair assessment, overview assessment of Morgan?
Yeah, and he's not on his own. There's, you know, others who, I mean, he worked a lot with Lord Joseph Devine, who was a famous purveyor of European art and antiquities. And he sold a lot of what I call the good stuff to Morgan, also to Frick, to Andrew Mellon, Peter Widener. He also sold a lot of questionable artwork to newly minted millionaires like the Vanderbilts. And I think this is interesting. When a lot of these buildings, so the Morgan is one of them, the Frick is another, they were purposely designed to showcase collections. And so in some cases, the architecture was the backdrop to the artwork, to the manuscripts, to whatever they were going to be showing. You don't get that with a lot of the Vanderbilt mansions, because the Vanderbilt mansions didn't have these great, for the most part, these great collections. And so that's why the interior architecture is just dripping in embellishment, because they made the architecture the focal point. So it's two very different ways of looking at this kind of old money and new money. But the Morgan Library, when he had McKim design it, it's basically, it's a little jewelry box. It is just designed to store this amazing collection that he had accrued over the years. And, you know, famously, when he passed away at his funeral, Rockefeller said he wasn't that rich and he owned all of us. And the reason he said that was because he actually had very little money in hard cash. Most of his wealth was in art and antiquities, which when he passed away, his family had to sell because they couldn't afford to pay all of the death taxes.
Now, one of the things that I want to comment to listeners about your book at this stage is that one of the extraordinary things about it is that you can see extraordinary detail in these buildings. You get a sense of the grand spaces, but your photography in the book shows incredible detail, particularly at the Morgan, true of others as well, which we would never, ever be able to see without those photographs in your book. So can you talk for a little bit about Charles Fallon McKim? And you said you loved him. What was important about him, and why did Morgan choose him to create the library?
Well, by that time, Hunt had passed away, and so McKim was very much the leading architect of the day. The most famous architect of the day now is Stanford White, but at the time, he was not considered the most accomplished architect. He was a very talented architect, but he was the junior partner at McKim, Mead & White. I think Stanford White got 25% of the profits. McKim got like 44% of the profits, something like that, 42%. And so McKim was seen as the leading architect of the day. At the same time that he's building the Morgan, he's also in charge of, he's designed Penn Station, which is the largest engineering and architectural project of its day. And so he was the architect of choice that people went to for these large civic buildings. He designed Columbia University. I mean, it's just this endless list, the University Club, of these great buildings that he designed. But he didn't live his life in the tabloids. And so the interesting story is Morgan had worked with Stanford White on the Metropolitan Club, and they hadn't got along. And part of that is because there were two huge egos. And McKim was a lot quieter, much more polite person. And when the ceilings at the University Club were unveiled, and this is, you can only get into the University Club if you're a member or if you've been invited as a guest, but a lot of these murals, they weren't painted in frescoes, they were painted in an artist studio on canvas, and then they were installed much like wallpaper. And the beautiful murals in the University Club library were installed 5 years after it opened. And at the unveiling, McKim brought Morgan with him because he wanted to show off this, because he was trying to get him as a client. And there's this quiet moment between them. And McKim says, well, you know, Stanford White's crazy about this. And Morgan responds to him and says, well, Stanford White's always crazy. And then says, magnificent. And that's one of the reasons why he ended up hiring Charles McKim to design his little Morgan library. And McKim had a nervous breakdown working with Morgan. And at one point, he tried to get out of the project and said, let me just have Stanford White take over. And he's like, nope, I'm not working with White again. You go rest, get better, and come back when you're ready.
There was a detail that you give in the section of the book on the Morgan Library that I just adored. And it's the comment that McKim followed a tradition of classical antiquity and refused to sign the building. He refused to have any identification on the building that it was his work. What does that say about who he was?
But he actually is in there. This is what happened a lot. A lot of the sculptures would sneak in little versions of the... So at that building, there's a couple of sphinxes outside above the entrance. And I'm not quite sure who the sculptor was, but they put in his resemblance in there. And Cal Bitter did that quite a lot. If you go up to the Breakers, you can see Richard Morris Hunt is hidden in there. I talk about this when I give my lectures, that if you want a monument made after you, architecture is not a good profession to go in. The only standalone monument to an architect in America is the Richard Morris Hunt Memorial, which is on Fifth Avenue between 70th and 71st Street. That's the only one. They are memorialized elsewhere. So if you go into the New York Public Library on the landing of the steps that take you upstairs, a bus of Thomas Hastings and John Carrere, but they were added later. They weren't integrated into the design. So if you go up to the Bronx Community College and the Gould Memorial Library, the front doors there, these wonderful bronze doors, are not original. They were changed. They were added by Lawrence Whiteson, who's Stanford Whiteson, as a way of memorializing his father. So a lot of times people add things to buildings, but it's kind of unusual for people to have it be part of the initial design.
Now, I want to ask you the same question I asked you about the Met. When you go into the Morgan today, gosh, it is such a stunning space. There's his office, there's the vestibule, there's, of course, the library. Are there particular details there that you'd like to point out for visitors that they just may never be aware of?
This is maybe unique to me, but whenever we went to photograph a building, I didn't do any research ahead of time. I mean, a lot of these buildings I knew, but I didn't do a deep research into it. And some of these buildings, it was the first time I'd ever been into them. But I didn't do it because, and maybe this is the architect in me, I want to go in and I want to look. And I don't want to go, I don't want to tell the photographer. And in this case, the photographer was a gentleman called Jonathan Walland, who did all of its photography, and it is all spectacular. But I didn't want to go in with like, okay, somebody else photographed this, so we've got to do this, we've got to do this. I looked. And one of my favorite details in the Morgan is in the rotunda, which is the main entrance you come in, and then all the rooms kind of filter off that. If you look closely, the walls are all made of mosaic tiles. And if you just took a regular photograph of the room, you wouldn't see it. It's not until we took a close-up photograph and a whole page. And most of the photography in the book is full-page or double-page images because we wanted to show these details at a large scale. And that, to me, is amazing. And apparently McKim sourced all of the marble himself for that particular space. And it just shows you the attention to detail that went into just the tiniest little things.
Now, the next building I would love to talk about is the New York Public Library. So now we're up to about 1911, and we're looking at another architectural team that some listeners may not be as familiar with. And we're talking about Carrier and Hastings, John Mervyn Carrier and Thomas Hastings. So, and they created a number of notable buildings. They had work in Manhattan and Washington, D.C., Palm Beach. Can you talk a little bit about who they were and what their contributions in general were at this point?
So, Carrère came from a wealthy Brazilian family. His family were coffee traders. And he goes to study at the École des Beaux-Arts and then goes to work at McKim, Mead & White. Thomas Hastings doesn't come from a wealthy family, but his father is a very well-known Presbyterian minister. And his congregation basically get together to help to pay for Hastings to go and study at the École des Beaux-Arts. And he too goes and works at McKim, Mead & White. And this is where the two of them met. They actually they weren't friends at the École, but they became friends while they were working at McKim, Mead & White. And Hastings is a very talented designer, incredibly talented designer. Charles McKim used to refer to him as Mr. Good Plan, and Hastings referred to McKim as Mr. Good Facade. Carrère is more of the organizer. He is he's the managing partner. He's the one who gets it all done. The equivalent to that at McKim, Mead & White was William Rutherford Mead. He wasn't a designer. He ran the office. And so there really is a separation kind of church and state and responsibilities, which allowed these two, when they left McKim, Mead & White, to work so well together. And all of their early commissions come from one of Thomas Hastings' father's parishioners, who is Henry Flagler. And so Henry Flagler hires them to do all of this work down in Florida. So they do the Ponce Leon Hotel. They design Flagler's museum, Flagler's mansion, Whitehall in Palm Beach. And that's really what puts them on the map. And then they come back to New York, and there is a competition to see who will be the architects of New York Public Library. And the interesting thing with this is, like I said before, the impetus of this is Boston Public Library, designed by Charles McKim. And it's a beautiful building, but it does not function very well as a library. And the director of New York Public Library, a gentleman called Billings, was very much aware of this. And he came up with this design guidelines to give to everyone who entered the competition. But they wanted McKim. They always wanted McKim to design this. He's the leading architect of the day. But the problem is, McKim pays no attention to the guidelines. And despite this, he makes it down to the final three. And they go back to him and they're like, Charles, just design it as we want it, and the commission's yours. And he refuses, and so the commission ends up going to Carrère and Hastings, which is pretty amazing. And most of it is designed by Thomas Hastings. Like I said, Carrère, it's so sad. He literally passed away a couple of weeks before it opened. He's one of the first pedestrian fatalities of a motor vehicle accident on the streets of New York City. And just a little bit of scandal and titillation here is Thomas Hastings gets, his father organizes a wedding to this very wealthy lady. Her father pays Thomas Hastings a huge dowry to marry his daughter. And at the wedding, Charles McKim is his best man. Stanford White is one of the ushers. One of Stanford White's son, Lawrence, is the page boy. And after the wedding, his wife, newly minted wife, goes off to Long Island to live with her female companion. And Thomas Hastings resumes his alleged affair with Augusta St. Gordon's in his newly acquired townhouse on the Upper East Side. So that's kind of an interesting little backstory there.
I think that would be a fascinating other show, is to look at those two same-sex couples and see what was going on there, don't you think?
Yeah, but you kind of see Julian touching on it in the TV show with Oscar Van Ryan. And so this is it's not a direct take from this, but this was something that happened quite often. And I think that's, for me, one of the fascinating things about Julian's show is how all the things that he's tapping into.
And there are so many of them, right? Right.
You know, the only thing that to me is amazing is that it took somebody so long to write this show, because all the material is there. And the architecture is the backdrop. And that's one of the things in my book. The architecture is the backdrop to all of his storytelling. So although we go into architectural details, a lot of it is this narrative of these wonderful people that commission these great buildings.
Now, I want to make sure in this conversation that we mention the architect Stanford White. And the reason I want to mention him is because, again, for so many listeners, that is who they think of as a Gilded Age architect. But we've certainly talked in this show about the story was much wider and richer and deeper than that. So can you offer a few comments on Stanford White in terms of how does he fit into this whole constellation? We've talked about Richard Morris Hunt. We've talked about Carrère and Hastings, all these different architects. How does White fit into all this?
So my book is 412 pages, and I have one paragraph about Stanford White's personal life. And somebody got upset with me about that. And I said, well, come on. I'm like, just one paragraph in 412 pages. If you don't want to know about it, you don't have to read it. But the two go together. And I think that how history is reported, people think is fact. And that's not the case. History is always reassessed and relooked at. And I think what's one of the interesting things with Stanford White, for example, is when he was murdered on top of Madison Square Garden, he was very much demonized in the press. After he's murdered on top of Madison Square Garden, he's very much demonized in the press. And part of that was because Harry K. Four, who'd murdered him, his family, were friends with William Randolph Hearst. And so it was in their interests to sensationalize this as much as possible so that everyone could understand why anybody would do this, anybody would murder such a scoundrel. Now, that's not to say that Stanford White was not a scoundrel. He certainly was. And I would tell anybody, I would recommend anybody read the autobiography of Mark Twain, because there's a wonderful chapter in there where he talks about Stanford White and he does not mix his words and basically says it was just, what he was surprised about is why it took so long for someone to try and murder him based on everything that he'd been up to. And somebody once wrote that if Cass Gilbert had been murdered on top of the Woolworth Building, would they be as famous as Stanford White? And I think the answer to that is probably yes, because most But most people would have a hard time actually telling you about, you know, naming a Stanford White building, because he's the one architect that has moved on to popular culture. You know, most people, if, when they think of famous architects, they maybe think of Frank Lloyd Wright, and they, you know, that's probably about it. And they think about the Fountainhead. They think about architects that have come into popular culture. And Stanford White's really the only one. He lived his life in the headlines. Now, that's not to say that he was not an incredibly talented architect. He was. But I think he was no more talented than Thomas Hastings. And I certainly don't think he was as talented as Charles McKim, and certainly not as talented as Richard Morris Hunt. So he's not the be-all and end-all. And I think that's one of the things I've... Not about sensationalizing his life, and I don't want to feel like I'm putting Stanford White down, but people need to understand these other great figures and learn about these people and realize just how wonderful they were. And you get that if you go up to Newport, because you get to see all these mansions that Richard Morris Hunt designed. In New York City, none of his work is... Three of his structures remain. The entrance to the Met that we've talked about, the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty, and then the Vanderbilt mausoleum, which is private on Staten Island. But his mansions lined Fifth Avenue, and they've all gone. If those mansions were still here, you would think about him much differently than what we do now.
Philip, I have to ask you my trademark Gilded Gentleman question that every guest gets on the show. If you could sit down with any of the Gilded Age architects that we've been talking about, who would it be, and what would you want to ask them, and what would you want them to ask you?
So because I knew you would ask this question, I thought about it. And this is the problem. When you do too much thinking, you come up with too many options, because...
You can pick a couple. That's okay.
You know, because you write this and this holds. You're like, why did they do this? And everything's not documented. You assume everything is, but it's not. So it's, why is the ceiling on Grand Central Station, why is it incorrect? Why is this meant to be the constellations, and it's not correct? And there's been books written about this. And, you know, the Illuminati is involved in this somehow. And, you know, the chances are they just made a mistake. But I would love to know stuff like that. But I think if there was one question I've got is, and one person I'd like to meet is, and this is very much off the beaten track here, is when Otto Kahn builds his mansion, and Otto Kahn is in the world of banking, second only to J.P. Morgan. He is the head of Kuhn and Loeb and Partners, and he builds what is probably the last of the great Gilded Age mansions up on Fifth Avenue and 91st Street, and he hires this very obscure English architect called J. Armstrong Stenhouse. And nobody knows anything about him. He's never done anything in America. In London, people know very little about him, other than he exhibited some drawings at the Royal Academy. And there is, no one knows why one of the wealthiest people in New York City hired this obscure English architect. And I would love to know the answer to that, because this obscure English architect would love to have a wealthy patron like Otto Kahn. So if I knew the answer to that question, maybe my architectural business would be flourishing a little bit more than what it is.
Well, Philip, you're not so obscure now with your publications, and certainly with the reach of the Gilded Gentleman and all the press and lectures you've been doing. Well, what would you want any of the architects to ask you?
So the house I designed in Palm Beach, like I said, we designed it in the Spanish Mediterranean style, and we won this award, the Schuler Award, which is given out by the Palm Beach Preservation Foundation. And I go down to collect this award. And in my talk, I said to them that I went into this process and I didn't want to embarrass myself. And they said, well, what do you mean by this? And I said, well, we're surrounded by, in this part of town, the estate section, we're surrounded by homes by Fazio and Meisner and Wyeth. These are all architects that I revere. And I didn't want to design a house that, I wanted to design a house that fit in and that they would be proud of. And That's what I would ask. I would ask those architects, you know, did I do a good job? Because that's what in the end counts is there's a very famous English classicist called Quinlan Terry. And he tells this story where he had a dream one night and he's in a room with all of his contemporary architects and Palladio comes along and Palladio goes up to him and he chastises him about his designs and not sketching enough. And the next morning he wakes up and he goes to work and he's very happy and he's recounting this story. And they said, well, why are you so happy? He chastised you. And he said, yes, but he didn't even talk to any of the other ones. And so I kind of feel the same way. How would those people rate the work that you do?
Gosh, Philip, there's so much more that we could talk about. We've only scratched the surface today, but thank you so, so much for sharing all your historical insight on the American Renaissance, on Beaux-Arts style and architecture. Thank you, Philip, so much for joining me here at the table today on The Gilded Gentleman.
This has been such a blast, and maybe I'll come back when the second book comes out.
That was my next question. So, Philip, do we really have to wait till 2025? Oh. And will you come back when you do your next book? That seat is ready and waiting for you.
We don't have to wait. As soon as we have all the contracts in place, I can let you in on who signed up.
Oh, but good. Yes. And my listeners will be the first to know
there
that. I would love to have you back. Thank you so much. Well, The Gilded Gentleman will be right here when it comes out. I do encourage my listeners to take a look at Philip's most recent book that was the basis of our conversation today, An American Renaissance, Beaux-Arts Architecture in New York City, for even more to the story that we only began to cover today. It's available wherever books are sold. And to my listeners, thank you for joining me for another episode of The Gilded Gentleman. The Gilded Gentleman is produced by Bowery Boys Media, and this episode was edited and produced by Kieran Gannon. To stay up to date on upcoming podcasts, special tours, and events, make sure to sign up for the Gilded Gentleman monthly newsletter, and you can do that on thegildedgentleman.com. And I invite my listeners to become patrons of the show on patreon.com/thegildedgentleman. Your support helps me to manage the costs of researching, writing, creating, and producing the show. I couldn't do it without you. And I'll see you soon. After all, what's life without a little glint of gold?
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.